Jessica and Gwen worked together at a local Sanford, Florida eatery. But these two hard-working women noticed Trayvon Martin's family had dropped in for a meal. And the two of them collaborated to make sure Trayvon Martin's family ate in peace, without interruption from any member of the staff. And they even took whatever steps were necessary to bring as little attention to the family, if any at all. Jessica discreetly made sure that the employees didn't approach the family, and it's very moving to listen to her as she tells the story. She remembers wanting to keep the atmosphere as calm and as quiet as she could. Gwen made sure that their order was precisely as they requested.
We're here at a local eatery in Sanford, Florida, and we're talking to Gwen McKinney, who has lived in Sanford, Florida for 48 years. Gwen, thank you for taking a moment to talk with us here at Syndicated News.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
Gwen, we were wondering, you've lived here 48 years, during you've seen this case, the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman murder trial.
Mm-hmm.
They finally agreed on a jury. They have no blacks on that jury.
I don't think it's fair. They could have, like, had half and half, you know, half black and white, or, you know, Hispanic. But just to have all whites, I think it's not fair.
Yeah.
I would like for Zimmerman to be able to do some time. I ain't saying he got to do a lot of time, but he needs to do some time for the crime that he has committed.
She remembers one man in the family's party as he approached her counter to place his order. She couldn't help but notice that his name tag read Trayvon. She read his name and glanced up at him, and he quietly whispered, "I'm Trayvon's uncle. Trayvon was named after me." In a day and age when most people are trying to get into the action and get a moment of attention, these two co-workers were kind and quiet as they cared for a family that had suffered a very painful loss, the loss of a child. These two women went above and beyond the normal customer service model. They showed absolute and effective compassion and shared their moment with SyndicatedNews.net exclusively.
Yeah, I just felt like they came in for lunch, not a press conference, that they got away from the courthouse for their 30 minutes apiece, and the employees, some of the customers wanted to interact, but I just made sure that on my part, my employees just kept working and allowed them to have a peaceful lunch and not have to think about it.
We're here at From Scratch Cafe. It's a soul food cafe in Cocoa, Florida. And we ran into
Stephen Tennyson.
Stephen Tennyson is a former military gentleman who's now working right here in the neighborhood.
I work for Mainstream Engineering.
And we're asking him what his opinion is on the state of Florida versus George Zimmerman murder trial. Give us your opinion.
My opinion is that I think had Mr. Zimmerman mind his business, i.e. listen to dispatch, stand down like they asked him to do, that young man would be alive today.
He said, I think that if George Zimmerman had listened to the dispatcher and stayed in the car, Trayvon would be alive today. Sanford, Florida is pretty much a typical Florida town. Where it differs is that the average resident is slightly older than most towns of comparable size. Homeowners run 3-1 against renters, and the typical Seminole County juror is generally white, a business person, and a tax-paying Republican. Case averages show that 90% of felony defendants lose in Seminole County. But this won't apply to George Zimmerman because having a Hispanic on the jury made it possible to get around calling this jury an all-white jury. In spite of the Supreme Court ban against conveying all-white juries, they are still commonplace here in the state of Florida. How such a throwback to the 40s and 50s still exists anywhere in this country is surprising. And it's exactly where the nation should begin its conversation about the justice system and its racial divide. Mark O'Mara leads the Zimmerman legal team, and he has steadily fought this 25-to-life reality that George is facing. But they've brought in Don West, and Don West is helping O'Mara shoulder this battle. West is a shoot-from-the-hip lawyer, best remembered for getting Crazy Joe Spaziano off death row. Spaziano was a motorcycle gang member convicted of raping and murdering an Orlando teen whose body was later found in an Altamont Springs dump site. What's more memorable about that case was that the witness against Spaziano remembered the case after being subjected to hypnosis. The case soon unraveled. But just this week, Don West wanted to make sure that Judge Deborah Nelson would prohibit the prosecutor in the Zimmerman case, De La Rionda, from using the words profiled, vigilante, wannabe cop, and several other words and phrases. He also wanted to prohibit the prosecution from mentioning that Zimmerman had confronted Martin. O'Mara and West tried to prohibit the expression wannabe cop as well. The expression wannabe cop, however, is not a put-down expression, but actually descriptive of George when you consider he's tendered job applications to work as a peace officer in the states of Virginia and Florida, but has never really been offered a position as a peace officer in either of those two states or anywhere else. Judge Nelson said that the expression wannabe cop will be allowed in court as it's the basis of the state's case. Last year, when this case was developing, several news agencies, perhaps competing for ratings, edited the 911 tapes and aired the doctored versions where the question by the dispatcher was removed to make it sound as though George was a racist, even if he wasn't. I spoke to Robert Zimmerman Jr., his brother, on Sunday, June 9th, by phone. It wasn't the first time he and I had spoken. We'd spoken in the past when we've run into each other in the hallways during hearings. I had asked him on June 9th if he agreed that his tweets, actually I called them Twitters at the time, I asked him if he thought his tweets were racist in nature, and he actually agreed. He said he knew that they were off, and I said, do you agree that they're inappropriate? He said, yes. And we continued. We had a fairly normal, cordial conversation by phone, and I sent him an email, which included that question, because he asked me to write down the questions and email them to him so he could run them by his attorney. I did that. He read my questions and answered me, so he can't say he doesn't know what I'm talking about. And that question is in the list of questions I sent him. On Monday, June 10th, he caught us all by surprise by staging an impromptu press conference. I asked him again if he thought those tweets were racist in nature and reminded him that he had agreed that they were incendiary just a day earlier. And here's my question and his response.
I asked you yesterday, and I'm asking again, do you find that during the trial when you let out your own Twitters that are, as we discussed and agreed, racist in nature, aren't you fueling the fire?
Well, I did not discuss nor agree to that.
I also pointed out that he was eloquent. The entire family appeared to be particularly well-educated, and his father was a retired magistrate judge. I asked him what possessed Shelley and his brother to lie to a judge directly, stating that they had no money when they all knew very well they had plenty of money.
Robert, as intelligent as you are and eloquent, and as well-educated as your family, as your father being a magistrate judge, what possessed Shelley and your brother to go ahead and tell a judge, we have no money, we have nothing? What possessed you when you knew you had funds?
First of all, I disagree with that they somehow collaboratively told that to the judge. Second of all, because Shelley's facing charges, I don't comment on that right now.
It was about $121,000 in one account alone, I remember. And we all even heard recordings of Shelley and George discussing this while he was in jail, which has always led me to the idea that they're very naive and immature to expect any modicum of privacy while one of them is in jail, is incarcerated. And again, he kind of denied the denial by saying that he can't go ahead and answer that question because Shelley's facing a perjury charge. Someone was screaming, help.
911, do you need police, fire, medical?
Maybe both. I'm not sure. There's just someone screaming outside.
Okay, what's the address that they're near? And is it a male or female?
It sounds like a male.
And you don't know why?
I don't know why. I think they're yelling help, but I don't know. Just send someone quick. Say, stop.
Okay. Does he look hurt to you?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right. What is your phone number?
There's gunshots.
You just heard gunshots?
Yes.
How many?
Just one.
And then we hear a gunshot. We've got to recognize that this is not George Zimmerman's first rodeo. George's lawyers are very sharp, and they love throwing little remarks out there. One of them that they say regularly is that George has never had a felony conviction. But even that's kind of a fancy play on words. You've got to consider that in 2005, his ex-fiancée filed an injunction against him. She claimed that he smacked her with an open hand, and he filed an injunction against her as well, claiming that she was the aggressor. In 2007, George had a physical altercation with an undercover ATF officer at a bar near the University of Central Florida. His friend, who was a bartender at the time, was suspected for and was being arrested for serving alcohol to minors. George objected, not realizing the men were ATF officers. He felt that they had to identify themselves to him. They felt they didn't have to identify themselves to him at all, since he had nothing to do with the incident. Well, the incident resulted in a shoving match. Now, George escaped having a felony formally applied to his record because he was offered and he accepted what is known as in some communities a diversionary program. You can't ignore the reality that he had to complete the program in order to avoid the felony charge. That's how it didn't wind up on his record. It doesn't mean he didn't commit a crime. It means that he escaped having the felony record stay on the record if he complied with the diversionary program. Not surprisingly, injunctions were filed to seal the outcomes of both cases. So wanting to learn what the black community in general thinks of George Zimmerman, we went directly to the genuine soul food restaurant known as From Scratch Cafe. It's located at 1641 North US 1 in Cocoa, Florida. It's owned by David Williams, and there we met several people and asked them their opinions. In general, everyone felt that if George had listened to the dispatcher's instructions and stayed in the car and not followed Trayvon, that the teen would be alive today, and that the senseless death would not have happened at all. Many people think that when a dispatcher, a 911 operator, gives them an instruction, they have to follow it because they have the idea that since they're at the police station, or so most people envision, that they are police, and whatever they tell you to do, you must. In actuality, they're lay people. They're not deputized by the sheriff. You don't have to listen to the 911 operator at all. So that's just one more point to clarify.
My name is Stephen Tennyson. I'm on syndicatednews.net.